It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Okay.
You know, I have to say, I just came over here after an hour on right-wing talk radio, KTHH.
Oh, no, you can't actually say the station.
Well, sorry about that.
Rule that we're not allowed to talk.
Well, in any event, all I've got to say is it's good to be home, you know?
We should have hosed you off before you came through the door.
Yeah, well, believe me, I did swing by and take a quick shower on my way over. So,
okay.
Yeah, it was good.
All right.
It's all good.
Glad they got you warmed up for us.
Hey, I'm awake this week for a change.
And it's good that we have Maria back.
Yes.
Yes, so.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
We missed you last week. We didn't have anything to talk about.
So let's dive into it. We have a lot to cover in a few less minutes this week. Local stuff. Let's start with school board candidates aren't faring so well.
Yeah, we had and there's going to be a decision on Tuesday.
School superintendent.
Oh, and if this seems like an incredible rush job, it is. Rush Limbaugh reference, not intended. But here you have a school board, three of whose members out of seven are incumbents up for re-election this fall. Every one of them fared poorly in the primary against reform challengers. Two of the reform challengers beat them outright, quite handily, in fact. The two that were beaten were school board president Nancy Waldman and Steve Brown, who chairs the finance committee, those being sort of the hot spots of the school board. So the community is pretty much up in arms about the school board and about how the school district is run. And it was the same dynamic that forced Joseph Olszewski out of the superintendent's job. So what do we have but the school board going out and expediting a search for a new superintendent? And you have you bring in four finalists. You name them last Sunday. You bring them in for a quick dog and pony show into town, and they're going to name the winner, the new superintendent of Seattle schools, out of these four on Tuesday in a week, when we are 3 weeks away from having probably a wholesale changing of the guard of the school board. The whole process stinks. So let's start with that, and then you take a look at who the four finalists are. We had one of them withdraw last night. That was Dr. Joan Koval, who is currently in Florida. Before that, it was in Hayward, California, in the Bay Area. In both of the last two districts that she was in, her contract was bought out. The Hayward job, which ended last year, she only lasted in Florida for less than a year. The Hayward district, the state of California is about to take over the school district that she left behind because it's so badly in debt. And the FBI and the local district attorney have been cooperating and participating in an investigation whose results are going to be released in a few days now, of embezzlement, fraud, and a bunch of other unsavory practices, all of which took place under Koval's tenure in Hayward. That was the most controversial of the four candidates. All four of them, Koval and the other three as well, including one other candidate who was run out of town in
Cincinnati.
What
I want to know is how she got to be one of the finalists.
Well, this is what I'm getting to also. All of them have reputations as sort of my way or the highway people, folks who have had a great deal of controversy in their past jobs in school districts for clashing with the school board or clashing with the teachers union or for whomever, and having a hard time working along with people. And so that's the question that you have. That's what you ask. You have Nancy Waldman coming out at the school board president coming out of the press conference last Sunday saying that ProSearch, the Milwaukee firm that did the search for the school district, has done due diligence on all of these folks. We've looked them over very carefully because of all the criticisms that we've received, and they all received an absolutely clean bill of health. Well, being investigated by the FBI for embezzlement and misuse of funds in a school district that is on the verge of bankruptcy and about to be taken over by the state might raise a red flag for some people. Having this happen in the context of bringing somebody into a school district that just had a $32 million hole appear in the middle of its budget, is laying people off, isn't having classes this fall that it should, isn't having supplies for the kids that it should, is putting off needed capital repairs that it should have, should raise a red flag. Having a school board and administration and a school district that is being criticized pretty much across the board by a public and by parents and by teachers in a community for being unaccountable, for not being willing to listen to the public, for saying, in other words, my way or the highway. It should be a red flag that you don't want to bring in somebody who has that as the red flag in their background. I mean, it's, what are these people thinking? What is Nancy Waldman thinking? What are any of the people on the school board thinking to have this pool of candidates? And so you have the community advisory board that is supposedly helping the school board make this decision, recommend that none of these four be hired. You have Greg Nichols, and this is both politically savvy on his part and also somewhat of an extraordinary step, coming out and sending a letter on Thursday once Koval's background became more clear. And I should say, I happened to be meeting with Breida Butler-Wall last Sunday night at the benefit for Eat the State that you were at too, Mike, or where she comes running up at the end of the evening saying, you know, I just got the information on the school board superintendent, on the school superintendent finalists, and you won't believe what they found on some of these people with like a 10-minute search on Google. It's like none of this stuff was difficult to find. So it took Nancy Waldman and these folks until Wednesday or Thursday to start making this an issue after the community is in an uproar. And you have Greg Nichols, once these folks have come to town and at the Dog and Pony Show, it becoming very clear that there's a lot of community dissatisfaction. Nichols is also recommending that none of these four be hired, that the school board start over. And of course, by starting over, it would also mean starting over after the November election, when you have new people on the board, when you have folks that the community wants on the board, on the board. Instead, we're having somebody rammed down our throat by essentially a lame duck school board who is hiring somebody exactly on the model of why they have been criticized and why they are a lame duck school board in the first place. This is what the problem has been in the Seattle School District for the last, what, decade, really. It really is an outrageous process. And what I would suggest to anybody listening who cares about schools in this community, call the school district on Monday. Call down to the Glass Palace, that fancy new building they built for themselves after running the district out of money. Call them on Monday and say you want to leave a message for the school board not to hire any of the four finalists. To start the process over.
All right. Well, you mentioned Greg Nichols, Mr. My Way or the Highway, and he had a budget that he rolled out this week while literally passing out pieces of cake, as I understand it. Let them eat cake.
Yeah. talk about people who don't get it.
Yeah. We talked about this a little bit on an earlier show, that the city is $24 million in the hole with next year's budget because, as I had predicted, they made an overly optimistic estimate about what their income would be in 2004. So now they have to sit down late this year, sometime in the next 6 weeks or so, and write up a new budget for next year. Usually they write, just like the state does and just like the county does, they write a biennial budget, which will cover 2 years. And this current budget should have covered 2003 and 2004. But when I looked at it at the end of 2002, I said, well, look at this budget for 2003, looks pretty good. But what worries me the most is the budget proposed for 2004 assumes that the economy is going to start zooming ahead again in 2003. And there's going to be all of this income that I don't think is going to be there. And sure enough, when I looked at Greg Nichols' proposed budget, that's the first thing that stood out, is that if you look at his proposed revisions, they look very similar to what was spent in 2003. And so if they had sat down and said, well, if they hadn't been listening to all the economic happy talk, and they had sat down and said, well, let's look at what we've got proposed for 2003, and let's assume that things are not going to change a whole lot more for 2004, then we wouldn't be going through this process again at the end of the year trying to revise the budget all over again. So that's the first thing that stood out for me. Now, there are two sides to any budget, your income side and your expense side, right? Your income is what you take in. Your expenses are what you're going to be spending for the year. Now, as far as the income side of the budget, the major problem is that total tax collections are down. Now, you can expect that for a recession, that your taxes are going to be a lot lower. But they also made some significant errors when they tried to estimate how much money they'd bring in, for example, court fines, and most particularly in interest income. Interest income is something that you usually get on your savings or your investments, or you have money sitting around in a checking account or money sitting around in various accounts collecting interest, waiting for you to spend it throughout the year. That's what interest income in the budget is. And the interest income in this budget is less than half of what the actual interest income that they're now expecting is less than half of what they had originally assumed. So you can see that that in itself is an indicator that they assumed that the economy was going to just start leaping and jumping around and producing all this extra money that didn't come in. So now if we look
and this is a hole that the state has gotten itself into, the federal, the city, Bush's budget nationally, where they have these rosy expectations. This is something a lot of governments are doing right now.
Yeah, and it's really relying on the sort of economic happy talk that Wall Street is producing about how we want people to invest, we want people to spend, so we're going to give them all this happy talk and make them think that things are going better than they really are. And the sad part is that economists are now relying on that happy talk to draw up these budgets, and it's creating a big problem. However, that $24 million shortfall is really not a huge part of the budget. It only comes down to maybe about a little less than a 1% cut that has to be spread out over all of the departments when you look at how much these various departments can spend. Now we're talking about the expense side of the budget, all the money that's going to get spent during the year. Now there are some broad categories that the city funds. It funds arts, culture, and recreation, funds health and human services, neighborhoods and development, public safety, which is your cops, courts, and fire department. It funds our city utilities, like city light, et cetera. And it funds its general operating expenses like the city council, the mayor, and various city departments. Now, you would expect Greg Nichols to say, okay, we passed a biennial budget, we made our priorities, we set them out when we did that, now we have to cut them about 1% each department, right? And that he would spread it out over the various departments. But no, he hasn't done that. He's looked at the budget and he's shifted money around. Now what he's done is he's taken money from various things that he thinks are not important and he's shifted it to things that he thinks are more important.
Like his own office.
Well, no, his own office actually takes a cut, but
not really, because that was a big to-who before about increasing money for his office.
So. Yeah, that was in the yes. When the biannual budget was originally.
So that actually
passed.
Surprises me.
Yeah, it's taken a little cut, which is actually pretty much in line with what all the various other departments should be taking. But there are some departments in the budget that take a much bigger cut than they should have to. For example, the Arts, Culture, and Recreation Department is taking a far bigger cut than it should. And just as an example, the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs takes an 8% cut. The Seattle Center takes a 5% cut. However, some of that money gets shifted into the Libraries for All Project Fund. Now, that is the smallest budget within the Arts and Cultural Department, and Nichols took a little bit of money from those other departments and shifted it to that one because that's one that he can hold up when it comes time for his reelection and say, look, I'm funding these new neighborhood libraries. Isn't that great? Now, on the other hand, if we look at the Neighborhoods and Development Department, there's one thing within that department that's getting cut very, very severely. It's the Department of Neighborhoods itself is taking something like a 17-18% cut, which I think is really meant to be payback for the fact that neighborhood groups have thrown a monkey wrench into Nichols' plans for things like development of Northgate, the U District, and South Lake Union. A lot of that money is being shifted out.
So what we're seeing really, it sounds like, is Greg Nichols using the opportunity that's presented by having to create some changes in the budget because of the shortfall to do some other things within the budget that were not part of the original budget vision at all. He's doing
right.
more than just making up for the shortfall. He's also changing the priorities of the
budget.
He's
changing the priorities to fund projects that he thinks are important.
And pull funding from projects that have politically opposed him.
Yeah, that he thinks are not important or that he thinks have thwarted him in some way in the past. Now, this whole budget process is going to be coming up for review. The city council has to go through, look at the details of his budget, take testimony from the public, and then sit down and draw up what they think is the budget should be and make changes, and then they will pass a revised budget. That's all going to happen in about the next 6 weeks to 2 months. Now, the first time people will have a chance to really testify in public to the city council about what they think the priorities ought to be is going to be next Wednesday at 5:30 in the city council chambers when they start talking about the budget.
Okay, let's jump to national and international. Zacharias Massawi got a big break this week.
Well, it wasn't so much that he got a big break as that the federal government, which is prosecuting him as a avowed member of Al-Qaeda, as the lurid news stories put it, cannot seek the death penalty any longer. And the reason they cannot seek the death penalty in civilian courts is why they are discussing, the Bush administration and the Justice Department are discussing whether to move Massawi and, by extension, other people in the future that will be charged as various terrorists having something to do with 9/11, to military tribunals. The problem with the Massawi case that the government has run into is that Massawi is being charged as being an Al-Qaeda operative. They're trying to link him to 9/11 because they really haven't been able to find anybody in the United States that had anything to do with 9/11. The indictment against him claims that there was a specific gentleman, an Al-Qaeda operative from Yemen, named Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was his intermediary, who was the contact between Massawi and the people in the Middle East and Europe who were higher up in the Al-Qaeda food chain. Well, it turns out that Ramzi bin al-Shib was captured by the United States about a year ago, and that they are holding him overseas. And Musawi's defense lawyers say, well, you know, this is a pretty important part of this indictment that has come down. It alleges that, you know, that Massawi not only is an Al-Qaeda member, which is not in and of itself, a threat to United States security, he has to actually do something. And what he allegedly was doing, allegedly was plotting, involved this other guy that the United States is now also holding. We need to be able to interview this guy to see what he knows, what he's telling the government. There's a separate question down the road, of course, of whether we can also call him on the stand. And the Bush administration's stance in this has been, not only do we not want you calling him to the stand because that might jeopardize national security based on what he would say on the stand, we don't even want defense lawyers interviewing this person. And the judge in this case, on several occasions now, has ruled that the government has to allow access to this person because without it, Massawi cannot get a fair trial. There's no way that you can offer a defense against allegations that you've had contact with this individual if you can't even ascertain what this individual's story is. You just have to take the government's word for it, the prosecutor's word for it. And because of this, the Bush administration is saying basically, well, we're going to take our toys and go home. We're just going to put this into a military tribunal where Massawi and other alleged terrorists in the future would not have the same sort of rights of defense as they do under civilian courts. And that way we can execute him. It seems like, number one, the Bush administration is shopping around for the venue in which they can nail someone and, you know, have somebody's carcass to fly around on a flag and say we're doing something about 9/11. But above and beyond that process is happening at the expense of actually finding out how Al-Qaeda operates, what actually happened with 911, and who actually is accountable, because it almost certainly isn't some sort of low-level operative like Mousawi that the United States really has to fear and really should be after. But regardless, he should have a right of defense, just like anybody else should have a right of defense. And this really has become the first major court test case of the whole administration rationale of enemy combatants, and that you lose your rights to a civilian defense and to many of the rights that are guaranteed under the Constitution under due process if you are a so-called enemy combatant. That rationale did not really exist in the civilian court system until the Bush administration went back, took a precedent from World War II, and trotted it out. And most legal scholars and now the judges in this case also have also thrown that out. And it really is considered by most in the legal community a pretty extreme stance for the government to be taking. And now they're losing in court. And because of that, Mousawi may very well be taken out of the court system entirely, and the Bush administration will fire up its military tribunal system.
All right. Yeah, it doesn't appear that anything connected with 911 is really moving forward with any sense of justice or...
Well, no, yeah. But and mind you, this did not come under this week in Iraq. 911, it was not actually related to Iraq. That is a separate issue. So, yes, and again, 911 is something that we still haven't seen any real accountability on, either with the people who perpetrated it or for people in the government and the Bush administration taking responsibility for not preventing it and not reviewing afterwards how they could have prevented it.
Well, speaking of this week in Iraq... How about telling us what's been going on this week?
I will. I like the music, Mike. I just have a question for you. You know, wouldn't it be great if they held a war and there weren't enough soldiers to actually fight it? You know, it's actually coming down to that.
What if they held a war and nobody came? Yeah,
it's actually coming down to that. Colin Powell's been working his butt off to get a handful of countries to contribute troops to the occupation in Iraq. Those countries are Pakistan, Turkey, South Korea, India, and Bangladesh. Now, don't laugh, because India and Bangladesh in particular have contributed lots of troops to UN peacekeeping missions around the world, mostly because their soldiers are ready and willing to volunteer because the UN pays well. Now, this sets up a little system of what some people call peacekeeping apartheid, where rich countries contribute the money and the weapons, and poor countries contribute the bodies, their sons and daughters, for peacekeeping missions. However, none of these countries have come forward to offer troops. Pakistan has a significant Muslim population, as does Bangladesh and India, and all three of those countries want a UN resolution first before they contribute troops. Turkey won't do it because the Kurdish minority within Iraq don't want Turkish troops, and because Turkey cannot get it passed through their parliament, and of course the Turkish people are very severely against it. And South Korea,
it's a highly Muslim country as well.
Yes, and South Korea has also said no. They are in fact linking the contribution of troops to Iraq to the U.S. actually getting off their butt and doing something about the North Korea situation. So that's where that stands. There is a war, and we're running out of troops. So speaking of money for Iraq, the rich countries contributing money for Iraq, the only one so far has, of course, been the USA. And I want to talk for a minute about the $87 billion spending bill that's winding its way through the Senate. Now, folks will remember that three-quarters of this is for the war. One quarter is about $20 billion, and that's for reconstruction. Now, the week before last, the Associated Press got a copy of the bill, and they listed some of the details. It contains a lot of waste in it. For example, $100 million for a witness protection program for 100 people. That's $1 million spent per person. $100 million for 500 people to investigate crimes against humanity committed by one man, Saddam Hussein. Now, you could... Now, $100 million.
And this after the United States has already destroyed much of the evidence that can be used for that.
Right, right. Now, $100 million to prove that Saddam Hussein is a criminal. You could pay me $100, and I could sit down, you know, in front of the computer and spend about an hour and come up with information about Saddam Hussein's criminal acts and you could save yourself a lot of money that way.
Or you could just go interview people in the Bush administration who sold them a lot of the weaponry you used to commit those crimes.
That's right. $99 million to build 26 jails and prisons at about $3.8 million each. $9 million to assign zip codes to Iraq. You could send me for $9,000, fly me over, and in a week I could assign zip codes for Iraq. $150 million for one children's hospital to be built in Basra. $35 million for on-the-job training for private businesses. That's $35 million for private businesses. $500,000 for a museum for victims of Saddam Hussein. Now, this led one Iraqi, ordinary Iraqi, to quip, quote, "Okay, garbage collection I can understand, but statues? After Saddam, we're fed up with statues." And you cannot blame him. So this is all pure pork barrel, a lot of this $87 billion, and I urge people to call up their senators and urge them to vote against it, or to at least kick up a fuss so that some of that bill can be changed and amended to eliminate a lot of the pork.
Yeah, now, and there's also a question about some of the stuff that we're not finding out about within that $87
billion. Right, right. Now, the worst item is the $600 million to continue the endless hunt for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after David Kaye, the head of the Iraq Survey Group, admitted to Congress this week that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, he tried to put a spin on it that was favorable to the Bush administration, but it was a pretty pathetic exercise. So, really, it's come down to largely a matter of faith, kind of like believing in the second coming of Christ, you know, the second coming of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Yeah, and you have Bush coming out and saying, well, Kaye's report validates our invasion all the way around. That I mean, it's
that's
pure fantasy.
Lie.
If you go back and look at the very specific claims that were made time after time of the Bush administration of stuff they were supposed to find, none of it's been found.
None of it. Now, so this whole $87 billion bill would not be the only bad bargain that the U.S. has made in Iraq. Last week, the Defense Intelligence Agency employees at the Pentagon leaked to the press a classified intelligence report that shows that the U.S. paid more than $1 million to Ahmed Chalabi for useless information on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Most of that information came from about six defectors that were interviewed in late 2002 and early 2003. That's when the U.S. People at the Pentagon, Donald Rumsfeld and his civilian assistants at the Pentagon, were really desperate to build a case for war. And they trusted this crook, Ahmed Chalabi.
And he was known to be a crook.
Yeah, and he's known to be a crook. And then they checked their credibility at the door and listened.
Yeah, and then they used that information and waved around at the UN and in front of the American people to justify the invasion.
That's right.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time. I wanted to put two different calendar plugs in for people. One of them happening Sunday, the other one happening on Monday. Sunday, Dennis Kucinich is going to be in town or near enough. He's going to be down in Fife speaking at the Tacoma Longshore Hall, which is actually in Fife. I don't know why they call it in Tacoma. It's at 1306 Alexander Avenue, Sunday night. The event starts at 7. He'll be speaking at 8, or at least that's what the plan is. And then Monday night, Doug Rocky, expert on depleted uranium, is going to be in town. He's going to be speaking at Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard. That's going to start at 7 o'clock. So mark your calendars for both.
Yeah, and I want to put out a thanks, by the way, to people who came last Sunday night to the Eat the State dinner. It was wonderful. Had a great time.
Yeah. So with that, we pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Maria Tomchik and Jav Parrish, co-editors at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, other places where you find free periodicals. We can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word. .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, or if you want to donate, you can call us up at 903-9461, area code 206.